What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone. On this episode of Eyewitness History, I speak with author and war veteran Benjamin Sledge. Bronze Star and Purple Heart recipient Benjamin Sledge reveals the true horrors of war from the front lines and the struggle many veterans face from reacclimating to life after battle. While serving a portion of his time under the Special Ops Command, Benjamin Sledge fought to keep his humanity amid the killing fields of Iraq and Afghanistan. Through brutal, honest storytelling, his book, Where Cowards Go to Die, reveals an unflinchingly honest portrait of war that few dare to tell. Stationed at a small base on the border of Pakistan in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the young warrior returned home shattered after embracing the barbarity he witnessed around him. Haunted by his experiences overseas, he began a 15-year odyssey wrestling with mental health, purpose, and faith, an odyssey that eventually drove him to volunteer for another combat tour in the deadliest city of the Iraq War, Ramadi. And now I give you Benjamin Sledge. Okay, I'm here with Benjamin Sledge. Benjamin, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. No, it's an honor to have you, sir. I want to discuss your history, obviously. I want to discuss your book, Where Cowards Go to Die, as well. But before we get into all that, please tell our listeners who you are and what you do.
So, as you said, my name is Benjamin Sledge. I'm kind of a jack of all trades now. I started in the military. Did that for 11 years and was a reservist, but ended up on like 4 years of active duty in combat. Then I moved over to kind of a creative director role where I stayed in some capacity for about 13 years. I'm a graphic designer, web developer by trade. So I do that. Started writing. Writing platform took off. Have about 45,000 followers on the platform Medium that read my work, also Substack. So just kind of dabbled my feet in there. So I write and then I ghostwrite for people. And then I do developmental editing. And then I worked 10 years for a company called Heart Support, which was founded by Jake Lors. He's the lead singer of the Grammy-nominated metal band August Burns Red. And we work in mental health or worked in mental health. And so I have multiple certifications in crisis response, trauma care, suicide prevention, and give keynote talks on mental health and the struggles that veterans face when reintegrating. So a lot of stuff going on. But recently, it's just been writing and kind of full-service content creation for people. So that's a little bit about me and what I do now.
No, fantastic, Ben. I appreciate it. So starting at the beginning then, Ben, how and why did you come to join the military?
So, there's this joke in the military that it runs in the blood. And it really does. If you look at like Patton's kids, they all served in the military. I think McChrystal's kids are like serving in the military. And my family just has this really long lineage of military history. So my grandmother's traced it back as far as a general under Napoleon, which is kind of wild. And then we seem to have fought in like every major American armed conflict. So my great-great-grandfather fought in World War I. My grandfather fought in World War II. Both of them did. And then my great uncle stormed the beaches in the Pacific. Both my uncles joined during Vietnam. Skip my dad. He tried to join during Vietnam, but was disbarred for asthma. And then both me and my brother joined. But to simplify it down a little bit, it's like, okay, this is what the Sledge men do. I needed money for college. So I joined because my parents are like, you're going to college. It's like, how are we going to afford that? They're like, figure it out. We can't pay for it. So that's what I did.
Wow. Excellent. Where does the nickname Hollywood come from? I read the book.
Oh, you're a good man. You're a good man. So Hollywood was my moniker in Afghanistan. And it was because I was just kind of this, I would say, self-obsessed frat boy. And here, I need to preface that. Like, fraternity guys get a really bad rap. And I had phenomenal fraternity brothers. I loved my time in my fraternity house, but kind of my own level of jackassery got ratcheted up a notch, I guess you would say, during college, because I grew up as like kind of the art kid and also the goth and metal kid. And so you got picked on a lot. And so eventually my own insecurities kind of came out and I was like, I'm going to be the man. And so I got really fratty, like in a bad way. That was somewhat amusing, but we were leaving for Afghanistan and I was actually really afraid to go overseas. So I put on this brave face as far as everything and just really started pretending. I started pretending that, you know, oh, I've got it together, but I wasn't really interested in training or learning. I was kind of this idiot young guy. And I had this team sergeant named Paul Gonzalez. He went by Gonzo. And we were in the middle of training and we had this like fake war going on, preparing to go overseas. And my fraternity brothers called me and these girls called me and like sororities and all this other stuff. And we were planning this party this summer because Rush was going on. And they're like, hey, how do we make this liquor infused trash can punch thing? And so I am in the middle of a simulated war environment. And oh man. It brings me a lot of just anxiety thinking about what an idiot I was. But I'm inside this, you know, hollowed out concrete building. And, you know, there's simulated explosions going on. You know, we're in this fake war preparing to go overseas. And I have my finger jammed in my ear and my phone up. And, you know, I'm telling them how to make this liquor infused drink for the party that I'm not even going to be at nor attending. And Gonzo walks in and he sees this young punk kid on his cell phone talking about how to make, you know, this drink for a party that he's not even going to attend. And he just yells at me. He's like, hey, Hollywood, get off the effing phone. And it was from this opening scene and me, myself and Irene, it said Jim Carrey movie. I didn't know that at the time, but he just remembered it. But for him, it was, you know, here's this kid playing Hollywood, like trying to be the man. And he's really just an idiot. And so he told people in, you know, my unit about what had happened and the name just stuck. They're like, oh yeah, Sledge is definitely Hollywood. And so throughout the war until the day really I got injured in combat, I was Hollywood. That was my nickname. And then as I got promoted and people kind of heard about the exploits and everything that I did, it switched over to Sledge because I grew up, I became a respectable member of the military who's in charge of other troops. And then also I totally sounded like a G.I. Joe character as Sergeant Sledge. So that's the story.
That's awesome. Yeah. Right when I read that, I'm like, oh, there's no way I'm not asking him about that. So pressing on then, Ben, so you fought in, I hope I'm saying it right, Ramadi?
Correct.
Okay. So you fought in Ramadi with the Ramadan offensive, which I believe was the most violent portion of the war. Now for our audience, these were a series of insurgent attacks against coalition and Iraqi military targets from the end of October and during much of November 2003. Do I have all that right, Ben?
Well, you're mixing in some dates. So Afghanistan was 2003 to 2004, and that's when we went on clearing operations for the Ramadan offensive. And then Ramadi was 2006 to 2007, which was during the surge and was the most violent portion of the war, where you had just kind of this huge influx of troops go into the area. And Ramadi accounted for half of all deaths in the United States Marine Corps from 2006 to 2007 in Ramadi. And then also half of all daily attacks that happened in the country of Iraq. So both environments had their own kind of craziness to it.
Could you give your thoughts on your experiences from the 2003 offensive?
Yeah. So in 2003 is when I got deployed to Afghanistan, and I was always, you know, in and out of college. I would go to college for about 3 months, get orders, and then I'd leave. And so I was constantly coming and going, and everyone was just like, oh, so let's just does this military stuff or whatever. And part of it was because I was in this reserve special operations detachment. So I was going through the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and school. And then I got picked up for language school at Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. And then I came home and I was literally home for 3 months and we invaded Iraq. And I had known we were going to Iraq, but I was like, oh man, I'm totally going to Iraq. They're going to call any day now. And they call. And sure enough, they called like as soon as like I got off spring break And they're like, you're going to Afghanistan. So I was like, can I finish classes? And they're like, maybe. And and literally I finished my classes and 2 days later, I was training. It was wild. So I was training and getting ready to deploy. And so we go to Afghanistan in 2003. And I like to make this joke, the US media eye of Sauron just kind of like shifted over to Iraq. So everyone forgot about Afghanistan, and it was really kind of a weird environment because it was still the Wild West. And I went out to the border area, right on the border with Pakistan, which is where most of the fighting was going on, especially during that time period, because you'd have cross-border incursions with, you know, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and they knew that we couldn't chase. And initially, like I said, I was really afraid, and Gonzo kind of put that experience, like the fatherly, you know, I don't know, just brotherhood to it and you know, dad like demeanor for a hot second, because he was this gruff sergeant who just had ice in his veins, you know. I'm surprised he never earned the nickname Iceman. So he sat me down while we were in Kandahar and just basically said, hey, we're all going to be scared together, but we're all going to come home together, and I need you on our team. And so I went out there, and the thing that I discovered was I actually liked combat because of the fact that it gave me a profound sense of mission and purpose and direction. But it was also really terrifying too, because the area where we were at was called Organy, and it was stationed between these two mountain ranges where the Taliban and Al-Qaeda would just dump rockets into the base, 107 millimeter Chinese made artillery, and just hammer us. And so I was like, this is so stupid. Why did we stage here? And it was because there was a village nearby, the town of Organy, and they wanted us to have diplomatic relations. But we went out there, and it was like figuring out who were dirty tribal elders. You know, how do we do reconstruction efforts? How do we get girls into school for the first time? And then the Taliban would blow up their schools, and it would all begin anew. So it was crazy. And I felt like one of those tunnel rats eventually in Vietnam, because we were rappelling into caves. I literally have a photo of us where we hooked a rope to the front of our Humvee and rappelled into caves. And I've got just like a sidearm in this freaking cave. And you're just like, this is nuts. And out of that, it really kind of somewhat hardened me to the world and that environment. And I had to, when you're dealing with life and death, you do things to survive, because right. It's either kill or be killed. And so you kind of get to this really kind of almost dark spot and become comfortable with dying and almost seem almost immune to it. And then one day on December 10th, 2003, our base just got schlacked. And that's when my luck ran out.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit further about that. So you say your luck ran out. What happened?
So that day, Taliban and Al-Qaeda, we believe, I mean, it was 2003. I only have my like journal entries from it and my memories and talking to the other guys, but we're fairly certain that they teamed up with some Al-Qaeda guys. Cause you usually knew when it was like more sophisticated attacks, you had trained terrorist on your hand. And sometimes the Chechens would come into the area as well. So that day, some of the local nationals, the Afghans that we employed on base early in the war effort, so you wouldn't have soldiers constantly pulling trash duty or washing clothes, we employed them to kind of, you know, help the local populace's, you know, money and influx and whatnot. But they asked to leave early, and they're like, oh, you made excuses. And so we were okay with that. But then come to find out, it sold us out, because all of a sudden these rockets start dumping into the base and they're targeting every single strategic position, like our fuel depot. You know, they know where our trucks are. They're targeting bunkers, and they were really trying to hit our tactical operations center. And so I met up with a buddy of mine. His name is Max in the book. He's with the Joint Special Operations Command still, so I can't use his real name.
Sure.
And he and I gathered kind of the rest of these locals who were just terrified. And I don't think they had a clue what was going on. And we got them to a safe spot, couldn't get to a bunker. We rallied in our chow hall. Actually, there was this corridor where the army cooks would make food. And it had a little bit of reinforced walls. It had some ovens and stuff. We figured that could take some shrapnel blast. We got everybody into that corridor. And then Steve and I just didn't make it. This rocket exploded right next to us. And I woke up, you know, ears are buzzing. I don't know where Steve is. All I see is this blood trail. Initially, I saw a Dr. Pepper trail because he was just sitting there chilling, drinking the Dr. Pepper because we'd been through this before. We're like, whatever. And then it got real serious. And so he got blown through the door. And I found this blood trail over in the corner where I found him rocking back and forth. And he kept saying, you know, his elbow is broken. I'm screaming at him because I can't hear anything. Mm-hmm. He's screaming at me. This other guy runs into and cut open his sleeve. And it looks like a pop can had exploded in his tricep. And he had taken shrapnel and it hit some major arteries. So we're like, oh no. And like all my muscle memory kicks in. We drag him to safety. I'm injured at this point. I have no idea though, because the adrenaline and fear is just taking over. And we start patching him up. I run out the back door to grab medics. They had erected this concrete wall just in a few days earlier. And so I'm like banging on that thing. And you know, that's really when the fear took me. And I was like, we're going to die. This is it. This is the end. We're going to die. And so I start to run back and another rocket comes in. It knocks me to the ground and I burst through the door and I'm just like, they blocked access to triage. Where the hell do we go? And the other guy, I look at him, his name's Lopez in the book. I'm like, and this is me being totally afraid at this point, because it's all just, I'm starting to panic. Everybody wants to think that like they're the cool hero, tough guy until they're in that situation. And I'm like, it's your turn to get blown up. It's happened to me twice now. I'm out. And like, he kind of shuffled around a little bit and then he just ran out the front door and he was the one who got the medics. And eventually, just to make a long story short, you know, I start going in and out of lucidity. He's bleeding out. They can't start IV line. We call in a 9-line medevac. We get him out to the chopper. We have him on a litter. I don't remember even carrying him to the litter. Like, there's just like this big old blank gap at a certain point. And this is just what I've been told. And then, you know, my team sergeant, Gonzo, he finds me standing on the tarmac, just covered in blood and, you know, holding Max's rifle, and I'm just messed up, you know, and I look like hell. And he was like, oh God, you're hurt, you know? And he's, you know, the Iceman. He's like, you're hurt kind of thing. And he's an EMT back home and he could just tell like, oh man, he's concussed. There's, you know, his hand swelling. He's got holes everywhere in his shirt. You know, his arms are bloody. And my blood or, you know, Max's, I don't know, but, yeah. So that ended my tour of duty and I got sent back to Kandahar. So to have my arm cast, you know, the whole deal. So it was a wild, wild experience.
Wild is the word. I'm holy Toledo. Thanks for sharing that, Ben. One question I did have for you, I'd love for you to share it with your audience. What was the "you're all going to die" speech and how did it affect you?
We actually had two of them. So the first one, it was by this special forces sergeant, and we were going into this area where 3rd Special Forces Group was operating, and we needed intel, and this was the stuff that they were passing back on. And so this kind of like portly black guy comes in and we're just asking questions, and he's so gruff and so severe. And he's just basically telling us how like everybody gets shot in all the areas there. So we'd ask about where these teams were that we were going to replace. He's like, yep, that place is awful. You're all going to, he's like, everybody gets shot there. Everybody gets blown up here. Everybody gets rockets here. And so he didn't say we were all going to die, but it just was basically like, you're all going to die. And so we kind of nicknamed his talk, the "you're all going to die" speech. And it became kind of this running joke. And eventually Paul adopted this kind of hysterical little thing where we were in Afghanistan and we called it the "don't die" policy, where I told him, I was like, what if I'm afraid to die? And he was like, well, just don't die, adopt that policy. And it was kind of a homage to the, you know, "you're all going to die" speech. And then later when Paul, who's Gonzo, Paul Gonzalez, we deployed to Iraq, we're getting, you know, a briefing about where we're going, Ramadi. And it's not good. And we knew listening to that briefing, like what was true, what was not. And some of it was scare tactics, yeah. But they had an average of about a 10% casualty rate. And so, Paul being the dick that he is, and this isn't in the book, but after the briefing, just because he's just this guy, he looks around and he goes, 10% casualty rates. He goes, that means three of us won't be here that are standing around right now. And he goes, it'll probably be you and you and you. You're all idiots. And, you know, I'm just like, so we took like kind of these briefings, these like, don't die, you know, you're all going to die briefings basically. And they just became jokes to us, even though it really was a dangerous environment. And they were accurately preparing us for the things that we were going to face overseas.
Right. He would go on to become a motivational speaker.
I mean, he's still in the army. So, and I mean, he's one of those guys that has so many awards and patches, like nobody screws with him. Like
yeah,
he's,
the respect is just demanded.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, he's the Iceman. He's got ice in his veins.
That's extraordinary. I love it. I'd like to then read briefly from your book and then maybe get you to react and elaborate on it. Yeah. So the book begin quote, Afghanistan, 2003. 7 months into combat operations, the blood pooled into small concentric circles to the left of the child. Normally, I would have found his wheezing annoying, but I could only watch as he gasped for breath. Like a gargoyle frozen in time, I hovered over the boy while he stared wide-eyed into the dismal blue sky, end quote. Thoughts?
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
So yeah, that's the opening sequence of the book. And, you know, I wanted to catch people's attention off the bat.
Certainly
and just
did.
Kind of immediately place them into the gravity of war, where it's just like, oh, you know, what's going on? There's already collateral damage. You know, this kid who worked with his dad on base had unfortunately gotten shrapnel through his chest and had a what we call a sucking chest wound. And so I had been, you know, sitting on my cot reading a book and, you know, my window explodes. I hear this and I'm like, is that the howitzers or is that us? And then it's like, and, you know, the glass explodes and I kept this wood panel over it in case that happened because it happened before.
Right.
And then the sirens go off, the warning sirens, like, hey, you're under attack. And I'm like, uh-oh. And I've condensed that story into a way that it really works. And that's what you have to do with memoirs. But yeah, like I remember hovering over this kid and just being like, oh my gosh, this is the worst. You know, when you see kids hurt, like little kids, it just really messes with you. And people back home just don't understand that. Like that is a very unfortunate and natural part of war.
Right.
Anytime you are in combat, regardless of how much you try to minimize civilian interference or civilians getting injured, they get injured, they get killed. From World War II on, we've seen it. Whether it's our fault or others, it's going to happen.
Right.
So for me, it really was that opening sequence of just putting readers into that mindset of like, you're about to step into this world, get ready. And then from there, I wanted to take them on a really fast paced read where they were just burning through pages. And I did that because one of my favorite authors is a guy named Pierce Brown. He wrote the Red Rising trilogy and he's finishing up the second trilogy of his. And that dude just knows plot and pacing. So I like studied his books and was like, how do I condense my story enough to have people just ripping through pages? And how do I engage them from the first sentence? And really that was what I did. And my editor just loved it. And she said, you had me from the opening line. And that's what I wanted. And that's why I did it. But also really it's just to kind of people put drop them straight into the middle of combat with no reprieve. So everybody else likes to tell their backstory first. And I was like, we'll get to that. I need to drop them in the middle because I want them to know what they're getting into.
Brilliant. Excellent. I'm thinking about our listeners, and I got to imagine a good bulk of them would be thinking about mindset, the kind of person, the kind of mindset one has to have to be in all of this and come out of it and come out of it. You know, you mentioned just a minute ago, Ben, about the howitzers. And, you know, even as you were talking, I was taken aback by how blasé you were saying it. It was such a daily normal thing for you, right? So not just because I like to hear the sound of my own voice, but I'd like to quote, if I may, one more paragraph for you and then perhaps get your thoughts.
Sure.
So begin quote, there are no guarantees in combat. You're always one rocket or bullet away from a dirt nap. The trick is convincing yourself they are already dead so that every day you wake up breathing, it's a gift. Dead men have nothing to fear. So the sooner you make your peace with death, the faster you'll be able to do your job, end quote.
Yeah. So that was the trick to surviving. And, you know, it's funny. I was literally on a phone call last night with one of my very best friends. He's in the book. His name's Jake Starnes. Mm. He was one of my teammates when we were in Iraq. And we talked about just how you get to this weird spot where you don't want to die, but you become comfortable with the fact that you might die. And it kind of creates this zest for life where you wake up and you're like, oh man, I'm still here. I'm not dead. Whereas, you know, yesterday it could have been the end, but I got one more day to breathe. And really when I found that I got okay with dying, the fear left me. And I was like, I could do my job. And I wasn't afraid of constantly like, you know, what if somebody pops around the corner with an AK-47? Or what if this happens? Or what if I walk into this ambush? It was just like muscle memory will kick in. All my training will come back. I'll do my job. And if I die, I die. If I live, I live. The unfortunate, and it happens to all of us in combat. It's really strange the way that it happens. And you can ask any combat veteran, they've been through that process. And it's just like, yeah, I don't want to die, but you just kind of become okay with it. But I told that you're quoting from the time where my best friend, Dan Kyle Seitzinger, he replaced me in Afghanistan and he got killed a week later. And he had asked me like, he's like, he walked into country the same way that I did, you know, afraid and worried that, you know, he was going to leave his family behind and that he'd die over there too. It's the same things, all the fears that you go through when you kind of step into that environment. And so I was like, oh, well, this is the truth, man. Like just become the dead man walking kind of thing. And what's so funny is years later, I ended up like watching The Walking Dead and they literally use that like same, that's where the title gets its name from because the lead character is talking about how his grandfather in World War II did that. And I was like, holy cow, that's crazy. I didn't know that, you know, people talked about that kind of thing. But, and I did an interview as soon as I got back with like a news media station and they asked me about, you know, Kyle's death. And this is like 2004. And I told them, you know, they said, what were your last words to Kyle? And, you know, I kind of broke down crying on the phone. And I said, I wish I wouldn't have said that to him. I said, you know, I regret it now. I wish I would have just encouraged them. And, you know, I still regret it. It doesn't matter how true the words were. It's just the situation and the circumstances that happened after the fact just really weren't, they brought me no solace in the end because of the fact that he got killed a week later and I was the one who lived.
Right. Right. It's extraordinary. Thank you, Ben. I'd like to discuss faith with you a little bit, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm an open book about all this stuff.
quite literally, right?
Yeah. Pick it up, read it. You're gonna figure it all out.
It's all in there. So I had the immense honor of interviewing a Holocaust survivor. Who told me quite candidly, actually, that his time in Auschwitz had greatly weakened his faith, as you could, you know, imagine. In the wake of the horrors that you witnessed, the last instance, you know, being salient, how has your faith been affected?
So, you know, we got to do some backstory. So this is going to be a long diatribe. I've tried to keep my answers somewhat short, but
no, it's all you.
for the sake of your audience, I think this is really important. So in the book, you're going to discover that, you know, I grew up as like the church kid in the 1980s and 90s. So I was born in 81, you know, I'm like right on the cusp of Gen X and millennial. They call us Xennials or something, the Oregon Trail generation. You know, my upbringing was analog. And man, I remember like a lot of stuff as kids go through. And my upbringing really was, you know, Footloose. It's like, don't drink, don't dance, like don't have premarital sex, that kind of stuff. And you and God are cool. And there's all these prosperity televangelists on the TV all the time, you know, who are like, give us money and, you know, God will bless you. And there was just kind of this mindset where politics really begin to intermingle with the Christian faith. And it was, everyone was Christian in Oklahoma, the same way they are in Texas, just because like, that's what you grew up with. And if you wanted to do business and be a good business owner or whatever, you went to church on Sundays. And so everyone claimed the title. I don't think it really had a lot of bearing on most people, just from what I saw. And so when I was like 17, I was like, man, I think this is a sham. Because the church I had started attending was like led by this very charismatic televangelist guy who'd been on like Fire by Night or one of those programs back in the day. And like, he was embezzling money, sleeping with the secretary. I mean, just really perverse, gross stuff that like, you know, you look at and you're like, okay, you're telling it, you know, it's rules for thee, none for me,
right?
Kind of mindset, or the same way we deal with politicians these days. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, and I took kind of like that Karl Marx quote where I was like, this might be an opiate for the masses. And I was like, okay, well, you can't tell anybody this. And I'm not really sure anybody in my hometown actually believes this. It's just kind of like what you say and do. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to like step out and not talk to people about this. And it really began, and I was still identified as a Christian, but just because that's what you do. I mean, 70% of America identifies that on a Census Bureau thing. and yet we're all like, oh my God, Christians suck. Like,
right.
Like that's 70% of us. Like, you know? So anyway, the thing that happened was when I went to Afghanistan, you know, and I see this death and destruction, I'd gotten in college classes where I really loved existentialism. And so I was reading, you know, like John Stuart Mill's and, you know, Martin Heidegger and a lot of those dudes. And I just found them fascinating. And I loved, you know, Kierkegaard. And it was, for me, I began to have this existential crisis while I was overseas, because I was like, man, what is the point of the human existence? Because we are really good at killing each other. And this is the thing that drives me nuts about modernity, is we're all like, oh, we're so enlightened. Oh, and, you know, we're not as barbaric as times past. I'm like, okay, says who? We literally built atomic bombs. We can destroy the world now. I was like, our predecessors couldn't do that. Now tell me why we did that. People have no reason. It's like, they're literally, we cannot explain why we built weapons that can destroy the entire world, or why we have this kind of mutually assured destruction. Just in case another country wants to nuke us, we're just like, why not? Let's nuke them back and we'll just end this thing violently. And then on top of that, we created drone strikes. We have advanced and sophisticated weaponry. It's never been easier to kill people. You know, we're so enlightened, we're mass shooting each other to death. And I'm just like, right. I'm like, you gotta be, are you kidding me? So like the left and the right that like to purport that stuff, I'm like, you guys are fools and full of nonsense. Because I'm like, look objectively at history and then look objectively at our life. And you know, 40 years from now, they're going to be like, good God, how barbaric was, you know, the 2010s, you know, and the 2020s. So out of that, I was like, man, we as human beings, we're just going to continue to have wars. We're just going to continue to kill each other. Is that the purpose of the human existence? And so that question really messed with me. And I was like, because everybody likes to think that they have, you know, this intrinsic purpose. For you, it's like, you know, a podcast. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump in there. So yeah, so you became sort of a nihilist.
Yes. Yeah. And you kind of get into this like, and when you're in that stage, when you sink into that nihilistic abyss, it makes killing other people easy. It makes you doing things that would normally disgust you okay. because you're in war. This is what you do in war. Nothing matters. The entropic heat death of the universe is going to happen in 3.2 billion years. Yeah. We're going to be wiped out as a species anyway. So why does anything we do matter? Are you really going to remember me in 100 years? No. So out of that, this is a really dark place to get into. People are like, dear God, but this was the stuff, you know, that I was thinking about. And that question continued to plague me. And so I'd always loved, you know, my classes in art history. And I wanted to figure out like purpose and meaning, because I had so much purpose and meaning and direction when I was overseas. So I began, you know, reading like secular humanists like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus. And while I loved their writings, like the myth of Sisyphus to me was like the dumbest thing that I had ever read, where they were just talking about life being absurd. And I was like, God, this is really dark and stupid. And they're like, yeah, as long as you're pushing that boulder up continuously, you know, you can be happy. And I'm like, I'm pushing an endless ball of torment day up and day in. How am I supposed to be happy out of that? And then, so, you know, I studied Islam because, you know, we were cultural affairs experts. And what was interesting is there was even references to like Jesus and that, and like the Ahura Mazda. And then you had, I studied like Hinduism, which, and Buddhism, which was based more on kind of like karmic principles. And I couldn't really align with that. And then, you know, I just thought Christianity was kind of silly. And really it had more to do with like the followers than anything that I had found within the scriptures per se. And then when I got home from Iraq, my atheist best friend from college took me to church, and I began to meet these Christians who really lived out their faith, that cared for the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed, that were kind to people that had wounded in them and were honest about their struggles, that really tried to live differently and countercultural, and yet still be very much involved in the world and the community around them. And I was like, dang, I was like, these people are different. And they just like really encouraged me to read and seek out philosophy and, you know, intellectual arguments as far as everything. So I read like C.S. Lewis, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, went back to Kierkegaard. And so the thing that I really had to wrestle with, and that most people don't realize, is war is an extremely spiritual experience. And I talk about this in my book, because on some of us, like playing God, you have the power to protect life, take it away. And all of us like to think that we know what happens after we die. But there's no formative consensus. Like, I think I know, you know, based on my own personal faith beliefs, and you probably think you know, but like, there's no formative consensus. Is it the great nothingness? You know, are we evolutionary blips? Do we end up in heaven? Is it cycles of reincarnation? But when you point an M4 carbine rifle at a man and you pull the trigger, you send him to the great unknown. And there's something extremely spiritual about that. And I love this Vietnam veteran, Carl Marlantis. He wrote 2 New York Times bestsellers, and one of them, What It's Like to Go to War. He says, you know, most of us want to think of war like something spiritual, as a light-filled, wondrous place. And he said, and not this dark and gritty, grimy death and destruction. He said, but how could any practicing Christian not say that Calvary Hill is a sacred space? Mm. And I was like, dang, dude, that's deep. So I really began to explore. And what I found was, for me, I found Christianity emotionally satisfying and intellectually stimulating. And so I eventually just kind of landed the plane there, and I was like, oh man, that's crazy. And then realized that a lot of the dogmatic principles that I grew up with, like being told that metal was evil and all types of other stuff, was just like man-made institutional hogwash. Right. So, and I think a lot of people get caught up in kind of those silly dogmatic nuances, as opposed to really seeing what they can learn and grow from out of either their faith or even lack of faith. And that for me was what it was. And it played an extremely important part in my healing and returning to society.
That's wonderful. And it's funny you mentioned dogma. Dogma, I've always had an issue with personally, because it inhibits our ability to revise our opinions and thoughts in real time through conversation.
Correct.
Right. Because you're preserving all dogma is the preservation and indoctrination of an idea. So if a better idea comes along, that dogma can only be enforced through, well, force, you know, because you have to shut down that better idea in order to preserve your dogma.
Right.
That's a whole other podcast. Who is John Burke, Ben?
John Burke. It's funny. I'm heading out to see him here pretty soon, because I'm going to be speaking at Gateway. that's where I came to faith. There's a church called Gateway Church. John Burke is actually the lead pastor there. Really fascinating guy. He was an engineer and before he was ever a Christian. So he's very analytical, worked out in like California, and his dad was dying of cancer. I believe, I think it was cancer. His dad was dying is the main point. And he picked up this book called like Life After Life, which was the big one on like near-death experiences. And he was like, whoa, maybe there is something to, because for him, you know, he was into the, I think the world is the nothingness, just being an engineer and analytical mind. And he's like, maybe there is something to this. And he used his analytical mind to just kind of seek out and like ask questions about Christianity and everything else. And then ended up becoming a pastor and leading a church in Austin, Texas for people who are skeptical of Christianity, for people who are seeking deeper questions that want to, you know, kind of know, is this stuff bunk or is there any historicity behind it? Is there any truth to this? And his daughter, Ashley, funny enough, I was attending the church, you know, and still showing up like super hungover on Sundays and I'm helping out, you know, in kids stuff now. Cause I was like, man, you know, they've really helped me so far. I want to give back. And so I'm serving in like the youth group. Cause I just didn't have a great youth experience. So I was like, you know, maybe some kids could use some, you know, dude in this place. Who's a dude, just a dude trying to be a dude. And people begin to hear there's like, oh man, there's this like combat veteran in there. And he's like covered in tattoos and he's kind of, you know, abrasive and wild. And so they had asked me to share like some of my story, which I did, you know, the parts that I was comfortable with. And his daughter was like, you got to talk to this dude. His story is nuts. And he's got like, he's so cool and all this other stuff. And I was like, okay, whatever. And he contacted me and he's like, hey man, I think you have a real gift as far as like speaking and this ability to captivate audiences. I'd love to, you know, kind of help you with that. And I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. And I thought it was like the middle school, like pastor. And I was like, yeah, whatever, we can meet up. Turns out it's like the lead pastor of a mega church. Huh. And, you know, we just begin having these conversations about, you know, and I'm grilling him. I'm like, okay, well, if there is a God, and I went into that Epicurean mindset of, you know, if there's a God and he exists and he's good and he's just, how does he allow evil to exist? And man, he was just able to really answer my questions in a very analytical, intellectual, emotional, and a responsive way that wasn't abrasive. That wasn't like, you just got to read your Bible and believe kind of thing.
Right.
And, he became just kind of this guiding light in my life who was okay with me still being this like kind of know-it-all punk late 20s something. And he really changed my life. So he's in the book a little bit.
Wonderful. Sounds like, I was thinking as you were talking, he reminds me kind of Lee Strobel, if you know the name.
They're buddies.
Oh, no kidding. Are they really?
Yeah. Lee's actually spoke at Gateway a few times.
That's hilarious.
So, yeah. Yeah.
That's really funny. So the book, once again, is Where Cowards Go to Die. One question I didn't ask you, Ben, that I want to make sure I do, is what actually prompted you to write the book?
So I didn't ever talk about war. You know, when I got back from Afghanistan, I wanted to, and so I did. And I realized very quickly that was a mistake. Because as we talked about earlier, you get into kind of that nihilistic mindset of being okay to survive. And a lot of EMT, you know, first responder, military types, we develop that gallows humor because when the human mind experiences trauma, you have to find some way to normalize it. And when you're seeing like the worst parts, people's guts ripped open or horrific crime scenes. And so you develop kind of this dark sense of humor. And out of that, you say things that normal people wouldn't say necessarily. So for instance, when I got back, I would tell these stories and I'd be like, oh dude, no. Yeah. You would, I was like, this dude, we're in this firefight. This guy's head explodes and I'm laughing about it. Or I'm laughing about how, you know, we're running over these feral dogs with our Humvee in Afghanistan. And that's a story in the book. I'm not going to explain that. You guys are just gonna be like, you're a monster. I'm going to be like, no, read the book. So, and you know, people are imagining, you know, Fluffy or Frou Frou, their own dog, and just like horrified, you know, and they're like, dude, what has happened to, you know, this shy artistic kid from down the street who sang in choir and stuff, like what happened to you? And it wasn't anything that they said. people tried to be polite. It was all in their body language. And that's why veterans won't talk about it, is we can see the nervous laughter, the uncomfortable shifts, the fake smiles, and it communicates to us you're a monster. And so I was just like, okay, this is why we don't talk about this. And so but the war just burned inside of me. And most veterans who want to talk about it, we're just afraid of being judged because of the morally questionable things that we had to do in combat. So out of that, I just never brought it up. And then in 2016, I stumbled across this article, and I can't remember where it was, but you know, I'd struggled with post-traumatic stress, but had gotten better in some aspects. But there's just, it constantly felt like I got punched in the soul, where, you know, I think about some of the violent actions I did, you know, the way that I treated humans as commodities, the way that, you know, there's just hard watching people die, death, destruction, keeping photos of dead enemy combatants, staying up at weird hours of the night, you know, reviewing that footage, and found out there's a term for it. It's called moral injury. And it's when you're forced to do things that violate your sense of right and wrong. It's the psychological damage that's incurred there. And I was like, man, I don't think a lot of people know about this. I need to write about it. And at that point, you know, my writing had taken off on the platform Medium. And I had these kind of hit articles about just other stuff, ranging from Christianity to, you know, self-help to mental health. I wrote this article entitled "The Conversation We Refuse to Have About War and Our Veterans." And it's still out there, and a ton of places picked it up, you know, had like 500,000 views in a few days or something crazy. Wow.
Awesome.
So all these other publications picked it up and linked to it. And I was like, wow, I was not expecting that. Wild. And I was working with the editorial team at Medium at the time, and they're a very left-leaning publication, very well known for that. But they've treated me so kindly and with so much dignity and respect. I have nothing but praise to sing about them. And my editor, a girl named Stephanie, and she's mixed. She's a Black woman, but she said something totally profound to me. I asked her, I said, "Hey, you know, that was a big hit. What do you guys want me to write on next?" And she goes, "Oh man, we love your war stuff." And I was like, I'm not writing about that. No way. Like, that was a one-off, you know?
Right, right.
And she said, "Well, that's a travesty." And I was like, "Wait, what? What do you mean?" And she said, "You are the smallest minority in the United States. You realize that, right?" She says, "Less than 1% of you serve in the United States. Even less than that has served in the longest running wars of the history of the United States." And she said, "You guys come home. You don't talk about this stuff. And we need to hear the stories of humanity, complexity, barbarity." She's like, the American public is checked out to lunch. And she said, "The travesty is that these stories aren't told. We don't get to hear your own hurt and what you've endured because you guys won't talk about it." And I was like, "Oh, dang, she's right." Yeah. So I started writing about it, and they just got more and more popular. And I was like, this is weird. And other veterans are like, man, this is the voice who's giving us, because, you know, everything else out there has been, you know, "Oh, I'm a Navy SEAL." And there's a joke in the industry, like, if you're a Navy SEAL, you get a book deal. You know, you look at everybody who's like, who's like killing it in the rankings. It's like Navy SEAL, Navy SEAL, Navy SEAL, Navy SEAL. And so, but that's a tier one echelon group of, that accounts for about 1% of the entire military. What about the other 99% of us who endured 20 years of war, morally ambiguous quagmires that we're involved in, not knowing what we're effectively doing, you know, fighting for the men and women on our left and our right, and didn't feel like we were represented? And so what really drove me to write the book was, I said, our voice is not heard. I said, it's being dominated right now by a very select few. A lot of it's about, you know, heroic exploits as opposed to the terror, the complexity, and just the honesty of the barbarity that happens in combat. And since I've written it, you know, just released last week, I've gotten several messages from veterans who are just like, "Dude, this is the story that I've been waiting to have be told, you know, that encompasses our wars." And that's really why I did it. I wanted fellow combat veterans who fought in Afghanistan and Iraq to feel like they had a voice. And for the things that they couldn't talk about, the things that disgusted them, and the way that they thought that people would view them, to just be able to hand somebody a book and go, "Look, read this, and you'll understand me more."
Wow. That's excellent, Ben. I just have two questions left, and then you're no longer my prisoner. Okay. So you hinted at it in your last answer, but how has the reception been so far?
It's been really fantastic. I think, you never know as far as like book sales until the end of the month. So we'll see. That response, the biggest ones have been, obviously, the ones that impact me the most are other veterans going, "You told my story. I've been waiting for somebody to tell my story." And these are people from, totally different jobs, whether that's military, police, infantry, special operations community, or whatever, reservists, national guardsmen, active duty. Those are the most impactful for me because I did write this book for them, but I also wrote it so civilians could understand. And there have been so many people that are like, "Man, I feel like I finally got a glimpse into like what happened and how I can talk to my friends that served overseas." Cause I give them ideas as far as like how to do that, because it was two civilians for me that really brought me home mentally for more. And out of that, I've been extremely blessed to hear that type of feedback from people. But my favorite is that, people are like, "Oh, dude, I finished it." They're like, "I stayed up till 2 a.m. reading it." I'm like, and that's the type of books that I love. So if I love that stuff, I want other people to, just be like, "Oh, I had to stay up and just tear through this book." Cause I have books that I do that with. And then there are other books that I kind of like slog through, when you're reading like Tolstoy or something.
Right.
War and Peace or whatever. And so I wanted it to be a quick read, but also really, really impactful for people. And it appears, you never know, and I don't want to assume that that's been the case. So I'm very pleased.
That's great to hear, Ben. I'm happy for you. And I read the book, and for the record, I loved it. I'd highly recommend it to our audience. Benjamin Sledge, how can people find out about you, sir?
Super easy. You can literally Google my name. I SEO'd the crap out of it, search engine optimization. So over the years, like, you just Google Ben Sledge, everything that pops up is me. But you can find me at BenjaminSledge.com. If you want to buy the book, it's available at every major reseller out there: Amazon, Audible, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound. If you go to your local public bookstore, my friends have showed me that they picked it up there, which is awesome for me to hear about. I love that because I love bookstores, As a writer, you just kind of, that's the thing you love. So, and if you want to get in contact with me, shoot me a message or whatever, just even say hello, like just go head over to my website and there's a contact form, and I try and respond to everyone who sends in a message.
Brilliant. Benjamin Sledge, thank you so much for the time, man. I really appreciate this.
Thank you for having me on the show. Great honor to be here. And I appreciate the questions. They were great.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate that. I will let you go, and hope you have a great rest of the week.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye, Ben.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.